David Barsamian is the award-winning founder and director of Alternative Radio, the independent weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR presents information and perspectives that are ignored or distorted in the corporate-controlled media. The one-hour program is broadcasted on more than 125 radio stations around the world. David Barsamian is our guest. Thank you for joining us. With the election of Barack Obama, the world awaited a significant shift in the militaristic and aggressive policy of U.S. politics of the past. What has happened in the region of Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan? Has Barack Obama meant a significant change, or is this business as usual?
Well, the United States, Canada, as well as several European countries invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001. That occupation is going into its eighth year, and it is extremely unpopular with most rank-and-file Afghans. Afghanistan is a country of about 30 million people. It's multilingual, it's multi-ethnic, with the Pashtuns being the largest group, but not a majority. They're about 40% of the population. There are Tajik, there are Hazara, there are Nuristani, Baluch, and Uzbeks, and other ethnic groups. So it's a very diverse country. And what Obama has done is greatly escalate the war in Afghanistan. How has he done that? Well, he's doubling the number of troops in the country, and the military commander is already asking for more troops, anticipating the need for even more intensified ground combat and occupation. Now, you and your listeners should know about a remarkable and very courageous Afghan woman. Her name is Malalai Joya. And she's about 30 years old. She's from Farah province in Afghanistan, right on the border with Iran, as a matter of fact. She was elected 4 or 5 years ago to the Afghan parliament. You know, quite extraordinary at a young age from western Afghanistan. And she made a speech in parliament denouncing the government of the American-selected Hamid Karzai, as a government of warlords and murderers and rapists and killers. As soon as she finished her speech, in fact, she could hardly finish it, she was immediately berated and insulted, threatened with rape and violence, and she was thrown out of the Afghan parliament. So she still is outside the parliament. Now, she is someone who lived through the Taliban regime from 1996 to 2001. And she is reporting that the current situation in Afghanistan for women is at least as bad, if not worse, than under the Taliban. The democracy she calls a mask. It's false. There's an election coming up, but when you have over 50% illiteracy, it's very difficult to conduct a genuine democratic election. So I think we should be listening to women like Malalai Joya and honoring what she says, and she believes that, as I do, that the foreign troops have no place in Afghanistan. You know, I was doing a little research, and I came across this quote: "The Afghans do not want us. They dread our appearance in the country. They will not tolerate foreign rule." Do you know when this was said? In the 1860s, by the British Viceroy of India. At that time, Britain had already invaded Afghanistan once and was roundly defeated. It was to attack Afghanistan a couple of more times after that. So in 1860, there was already this, I think, very correct perception that Afghans do not like to be occupied, as people in British Columbia would not like to be occupied by people who don't speak, you know, English or French, who, you know, maybe they're from Bangladesh or the Ivory Coast or some other country. No one would like that in British Columbia, and of course, the Afghans don't like it. They don't like their homes being bombed, their schools, their mosques, their madrasa, which are religious seminaries being bombed, you know, all in the name of fighting terrorism. Terrorism is increasing in Afghanistan. Before the American invasion and then the Canadian troops and all the Europeans that have come, there was never such a thing as a suicide bomber. Never. Never such a thing as an improvised explosive device. All of these things have become very common now in Afghanistan because people are using the techniques that were first used in Iraq, and they're applying them to fight the foreign occupiers. So this war has no end. We could be doing this interview in 10 years, and it's very likely that the Afghans will still be fighting. Sooner or later, the Americans and their so-called allies in Ottawa and elsewhere will have to evacuate Afghanistan.
So who are the architects then of this war in Pakistan, in Afghanistan? Who are the architects? I mean, whose favorite is this power being willed?
The wars in Afghanistan and the expansion of war in Pakistan with increased bombing furthers American hegemonic interests in West and South Asia. Pakistan is a very strategic country. It has an enormous amount of natural gas. It sits astride the Arabian Sea. It has deep water ports in Karachi and Gwadar. Afghanistan itself is not rich in resources, but it stands astride the former Soviet republics in Central Asia, which have a tremendous amount of oil and natural gas. So, you know, there used to be this joke that Afghanistan was Pipelineistan, that long-range pipes would be built to deliver oil and natural gas to huge markets in India and in China. And what Obama has done is he has militarized the Afghan policy as well as Pakistan. He's done that by appointing a general as the new U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. This is General Carl Eikenberry. He has appointed another general, James Jones, as his national security advisor, and the overall commander of U.S. troops in Afghanistan is a man named Stanley McChrystal, who arguably is a major war criminal. He was the commander of the Joint Special Operations Force in Iraq, a force that had carried out extrajudicial killings, that is to say, assassinations, as well as torture. He has not been held to account for that. He is also the military officer who presided over the Pat Tillman scandal in Afghanistan in 2002. Pat Tillman was a famous U.S. professional football star with the Arizona Cardinals, and after September 11th, he joined the military, giving up, you know, his very lucrative contract with the NFL. To serve his country, you know, very noble instinct. He was supposedly killed in hand-to-hand combat with the brutal Taliban. He was awarded posthumously the Silver Star. And there was a whole lot of propaganda, particularly in the United States, about, you know, what a heroic figure. You know, he was killed in the prime of his life. He gave up everything for his country, yada, yada, yada. Well, it turns out that the whole story was manufactured. And McChrystal was the commanding officer who was responsible for the propaganda fabricating this entire story. So there you have, you know, I think part of what Obama's strategy is in Afghanistan. It's going to fail. In fact, what he's doing by appointing a general in a civilian post as ambassador to Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, he is replicating exactly what Lyndon Johnson did in the mid-1960s when he appointed General Maxwell Taylor as the U.S. ambassador to Saigon, thereby indicating that the military role was going to predominate. And it predominated in Vietnam, it is predominating in Afghanistan, and in an area, in a part of the world that is already seething with resentment and hostility toward the United States, toward occupying forces, toward Canada, toward Holland, towards Germany, and all the other countries that are occupying Afghanistan, Obama has decided not to pour water on these flames, but to add gasoline, producing an even more volatile cocktail that will only end up with the death and destruction of more Afghans. And let me remind you and your listeners, this is a country that has been virtually at war without respite, except for the Taliban period, actually, from 1979 until the present. As severe and as harsh as Taliban rule was, and it was very severe, it did provide a bit of a respite in terms of security for the average Afghan. Of course, there was a tremendous price that was paid for that security in terms of misogyny and, you know, the acceleration of patriarchy and particularly the oppression of women and total clampdown on human rights and freedom of speech.
When the war in Afghanistan was first declared and the people went to the streets, many say this is a war about oil. It has nothing to do with democracy, has nothing to do with helping women live in a more free society. It has everything to do with power. I wonder if you could comment about what role does the media play in creating, concocting these stories that enables governments like that of the U.S. and Canada to participate in warmongering with impunity?
Well, the media play a crucial role in manufacturing consent. They take their cues from Ottawa and Washington. But for example, you mentioned that one of the explanations, one of the raison d'etre for the invasion of Afghanistan was to liberate Afghan women, to which the great Indian writer Arundhati Roy commented, this is the first time in human history that the United States Marine Corps has been identified as an organization promoting feminism and, expansive rights for women. It's preposterous. It's ludicrous. That was just a cover story to justify the military invasion. I think people on the left generally overdetermine oil as the single most driving force in particular U.S. policies. There's been many examples of U.S. invasions from Grenada to Panama to the Dominican Republic where oil had no role whatsoever. It has to do with establishing U.S. power. It's about establishing the rule of the godfather, the patron, who will discipline all of those recalcitrant nationalist factions in countries where they may believe that the resources of those countries belong to the people in those countries, such as Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran when he was overthrown by the CIA, or Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, or Salvador Allende. I mean, I could spend the next hour listing all of the regimes that have been overthrown by the United States since the collapse of the Soviet Union and before the Soviet Union. You'll remember the major reason for all of these actions, destroying the Sandinista movement in Nicaragua, the FMLN in Salvador, it was always tied to the Soviet Union. So now the Soviet Union doesn't exist. What is the United States doing? Well, it has created a new Soviet Union, a new raison d'etre for its imperialist policy, and that is Al-Qaeda. It is radical Islam. It's become very handy because how else can you explain the fact that the U.S. is bombing Pakistan, a country that is about 95-96% Muslim, Afghanistan, which is 99.5% Muslim, as well as occupying an ongoing invasion of Iraq. I think a very telltale sign that the United States is intending to ratchet up its operations in South Asia and West Asia is the size of the new U.S. embassy in Islamabad. I mean, it's really amazing. It's going to cost over $1 billion, just like the one in Baghdad. It's a huge expansion of the U.S. so-called diplomatic presence in Pakistan, and we all know what that means. That means more CIA spies, more subversion, more military attachés who go to countries and pretend to be diplomats. This is not going to play well for Pakistanis. They don't like to be bombed. They don't like these drone attacks, you know, hitting their villages. They don't like being refugees in their own country because the U.S. is forcing the weak-kneed and incompetent Asif Ali Zardari, president of Pakistan, to attack the frontier areas and causing huge amounts of damage and a massive refugee crisis.
So what is the agenda for the region then? The fact that the U.S. is a mass producer of weapons, and if that is indeed your major industry, wouldn't it follow that you need to create a constant war to be able to maintain that industry profitable?
That's a good point. We have in the United States what a great sociologist at the Columbia University years ago, in the 1970s, I think, called a permanent war economy. We are either at war or we are about to go to war. This has been virtually an unbroken pattern since the end of World War II in 1945. The U.S. has been at war or about to launch a military action or to conduct some kind of CIA subversion, overthrowing governments. And let me include, in addition to military warfare directly, another very powerful weapon in the U.S. toolkit is economic warfare. For example, sanctions against Cuba for over 50 years, where, you know, the United States is completely isolated in that policy. Sanctions against Iran, threatening other countries with military as well as economic sanctions. So the U.S. right now is undergoing the Great Recession, the greatest economic decline since the 1930s. But there's one sector of the economy that's doing quite well, thank you, and that is the military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower called it in his farewell address in January of 1961. So corporations like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Boeing, General Electric, Honeywell, Sikorsky, General Dynamics, and on, all those war-making facilities, you know, are operating at full capacity, and so they're doing very, very well, generating huge profits. So there is something to the notion that the U.S. is trying or is interested in fomenting conflict in order to pump money into that particular sector of the economy. Meanwhile, you know, the country's falling apart. There's an enormous healthcare scandal here. There's not proper infrastructure for public transportation. Canada is way ahead of the United States, for example, in high-speed rail travel. We have all kinds of issues that should be dealt with here internally, but the imperialism is above all. It's imperialism uber alles, the notion that I'm saying Washington, not the American people, the people that run this country, they believe that they have the wisdom and the knowledge and the sensitivity to re-engineer other societies, such as Afghanistan and Pakistan, home to some of the, you know, oldest civilizations on Earth, you know, even though Pakistan is a relatively new nation state. It was created in 1947. People have been living there continually for 5,000 years. This is the home of the Indus Valley civilization, the great monuments at Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. So that arrogance, that hubris, is going to be the undoing of the United States, just as it was the undoing of Britain, of Rome, of every empire in history. Now, what's happened in the last 10 years is truly extraordinary by any historical standards. The decline of the United States because of this imperial war machine that has over 700 bases around the world and takes up such a large part of the U.S. economy has greatly declined in power. And we can see, you know, the emergence of China very soon, you know, a major force that will contest U.S. hegemony.
We are now hearing the rumblings of a call for a multilateral currency that challenges the U.S. dollar as the international currency. But talk a little bit about how this connects to the kind of influence the U.S. has on the International Monetary Bank, because this has always been part of the component that enables the U.S. to impose its hegemony without opposition by imposing that economic warfare that you described throughout the region, wherever that may be.
You know, as you say, it's certainly a major factor. The World Bank, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the WTO, the World Trade Organization, are by and large under the U.S. thumb. But that pressure from the U.S. thumb is less now than it ever has been since 1945, because the U.S. is much weaker economically. It's extremely strong militarily, but as an economic power, it is in sharp decline. And so, as Chomsky predicted in as long ago as 20 years, the U.S. will, because it is economically weaker, will be playing its military card more because it lacks the power it once had. And we can see through all of these invasions, occupations, and threats of invasions and occupations that that exactly is what has happened. The U.S. has a commanding presence in those international lending institutions, which have not contributed to real development in many of the countries of the Third World. In fact, have impoverished them even further by getting them into a debt cycle from which it is difficult to emerge, as well as building grandiose projects, particularly dams in India, Pakistan, and elsewhere, that are not what people need. People need drinking water. The projects that are being funded do not provide for basic amenities. In Pakistan, there's a huge problem with fresh water. The same thing in Afghanistan. In India today, for example, the largest city in India is Mumbai, a city of 20 million people. They recently imposed a 30% reduction in an already inadequate water supply system, in drinking water. In Bhopal, in central India, the capital of Madhya Pradesh, and I was there just a few months ago, it is a city of lakes, has had historically ample water. They are now experiencing acute drought, you know, with global warming and climate change. And they, too, have imposed severe rationing in that city in central India. So these international organizations were created by the power elites in Europe, Japan, and the United States. They were created to serve their interests, not necessarily the interests of the countries that they were supposed to be helping. So it is one arm of imperialism. It is one arm of domination. But again, I want to stress that the U.S. is in a greatly weakened position, and I don't see it reemerging at the level it was, let's say, before December 2007, when this economic crisis started to hit really hard in the United States, with millions of unemployed, with millions of people who have lost their homes, huge problems in the manufacturing sector, banks going belly up, and General Motors, the very icon of American capitalism, the very symbol of American economic power, is basically a bankrupt company that is now emerging as a shell of its former self, having eliminated many of its product lines, have closed scores of factories in the United States, and I believe they are closing factories and laying off people in Canada as well.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the United States in a declining mode. Throughout Latin America, and Latin America has been hit by many military coups architected by the United States. But in recent years, we see the resistance of people everywhere. In Honduras, the people in Honduras are fighting back. I wonder if you could talk about the resistance in the region, in Iran, Pakistan, in that region. How does that resistance visualize? What does that look like? And what can the world community of people contribute to a democratic society developing out of the rubble as this empire crumbles?
Well, I think to quote the great Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, what is required is solidarity. But what kind of solidarity? Not the typical, what he calls vertical solidarity, where I am the master and the one who knows everything, and you are the object of whatever that I project on you, and you know nothing. We need horizontal solidarity between peoples, between NGOs, not between powerful institutions that are not accountable, like the World Bank or the Pentagon, for example, and other institutions of power and privilege. What's happened in Latin America, and I think something clicked in 1992. I remember that year very well because it was the 500th anniversary of the conquest of the Americas. And I think a consciousness was ignited then. And we have seen, in, for example, Ecuador with Rafael Correa, in Bolivia with the extraordinary election of Evo Morales, the first, indigenous leader elected on the continent of Latin America, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and elsewhere in Latin America, in Brazil, in Argentina, Uruguay, for example, Paraguay, which was under the dictatorship of the Colorado Party for decades and decades, and had virtually a neo-Nazi government under General Stroessner, is now ruled by a center-left coalition. These are extraordinary developments in response to the tremendous pressures that have been put on the general population by austerity programs, by neoliberalization, by privatization. For example, the privatization of water in Cochabamba, in the Andes, in Bolivia, ignited a huge popular protest. No one expected that. No one could have predicted that. It was so powerful that the Bolivian government at the time had to cancel the contract it had signed with Bechtel to privatize water in Cochabamba. Now, moving to South and West Asia, the resistance is not the same as it is in Latin America. It can't be, because they are not as familiar with the United States as peoples and countries in Latin America. And when I say Latin America, I also mean Central America, Mexico, and we can also include the Caribbean. They have been living under Tio Sam, Uncle Sam's shadow, for centuries. They have seen the invasions of Panama, Haiti, Cuba, Salvador, all of the countries that have been invaded and occupied, and then the economic warfare that has been carried on as well. So people in this hemisphere, when they hear, stories coming from the U.S. media about democracy and liberation and free markets and free press, and open societies, they are able to decode that propaganda, because they have so much experience with the United States. They know who is in El Norte, who is in the North, who is this, giant that is has long dominated the Western and Southern Hemisphere. It's not the case so much in countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, where they're in Pakistan's case, experience with the United States is only from basically the 1950s. With Afghanistan, it came into high relief after the 1979 Soviet invasion, which was actually triggered by Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski, his national security advisor, by funding homicidal maniacs like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and other extreme Muslim fundamentalists in Afghanistan to destabilize the Soviet Union, where there was a large Muslim population just north of Afghanistan in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. In fact, they crossed over into the Soviet Union and carried out military action. So the Soviet Union was very worried. And, of course, Brzezinski then boasted that he had set an Afghan trap for the Soviets to lure them into Afghanistan because he wanted to give the Soviets their Vietnam. He wanted the Soviet Union to be bogged down in a long, unpopular counterinsurgency war of occupation, which is exactly what happened. And what the but the U.S., apparently, and Obama do not learn from history, do not know, you know, take the proper lessons. And they are making the same mistake that the Soviets made, that the British made, that, you know, Alexander the Great and all the various outsiders have, you know, engaged in by invading and occupying Afghanistan. Now, Iran is living under a theocratic dictatorship. You know, one should not confuse anti-American rhetoric and rhetoric about, you know, imperialism as, you know, automatically a great thing and we've got to support it. I think it has to be more nuanced than that. This is a regime in Tehran, and I've been to Iran, and I've written a book about it called Targeting Iran and many programs on Iran. People can go to my website, alternativeradio.org, alternativeradio.org, and learn more about Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and India, and other countries in that area. The regime is extremely oppressive to women. They impose dress codes. It is difficult for women in Iran to, you know, hold high political positions in the administration. All the ministers, without exception, in the Iranian government are men. Mm. Now, this is not to say these things is not to say, okay, that justifies a humanitarian invasion of Iran or bombing of Iran because they're undemocratic, they treat their women, you know, they don't treat their women well, they oppress minorities, for example, particularly the Baha'is in Iran. So there's an enormous amount of internal problems in Iran, but that does not justify any U.S. or Israeli military action against Iran. Iran is a country that has not invaded another country in 250 years. 250 years, it has never invaded another country. You cannot go in the history of the United States for more than 2.5 years and make that statement.
That's a very important point to make. Where do we find our inspiration to create a different society? I mean, are we destined to live like this, or do we have what is needed to create a different society, one that doesn't see war as a natural thing, one that doesn't see poverty as a natural or geographical incident, but rather sees the structural, how this aggression has been structurally built and maintained by those who are in power? How do we get out of that? How do we create something new and different that's inclusive and pluralistic?
Float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. Be agile. Be creative and innovative. Be artistic. Write poetry. Sing music. There are so many things that we can do. I'm inspired by the Afghan woman I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, Malalai Joya, who was thrown out of the Afghan parliament by the male chauvinist that dominated, who has been under death threat ever since. She has bodyguards with her. She is taking huge risks. What risks are we taking? What risks am I taking? Is it risky for me to talk to you on, you know, the Burnaby, BC radio station? No, it's not. It's relatively simple to talk on CJSF. I'm not going to pay a price. So I think there are people who are genuinely show enormous amounts courage, and we don't know their names. But obviously, society has evolved. Just take the treatment of African Americans, how that has changed in the United States, particularly in the last 40 or 50 years. Quite an extraordinary development. That didn't come about because the white power structure woke up one day and said, you know, African Americans, they're not being treated fairly. No, it came because of enormous popular protests, because of pressure, because of demonstrations, because of boycotts like the Montgomery bus boycott, which was sparked by another courageous woman named Rosa Parks. So throughout history, we have many, many examples of people rising up against oppression and fighting for justice. And, you know, like they say in Spanish, you know, poco a poco, si escala la escala, you know, step by step, you climb the staircase, as it were. It's not going to happen overnight, but we have made enormous amounts of progress. There's a lot of work to be done, of course. The struggle for justice is one that never ends, and I think to be engaged in it, to quote a great U.S. Politician, Daniel Webster, he said, the struggle for justice is the great work for humankind on earth. Mm-hmm. And when I see peasants in Bolivia who are not literate, who have none of the advantages I have, you know, I live in a house, you know, I have a bank account, I have a car, I travel around the world, I lecture everywhere, I have enormous privilege and advantage. But when someone like that, in a very oppressive colonial situation, can rise up and resist and overthrow the oligarchy, as it were, that's a huge thing. That is enormously, I think, important and inspirational. So one only has to look at the examples of people in Nepal, for example, who overthrew a monarchy, centuries-old monarchy, in a popular revolution. And then they were elected by large numbers to political power. So you have, you know, all kinds of examples. In Pakistan, recently, there was a very popular movement to restore the integrity of the justice system, which had been completely trampled on by the U.S. puppet General Pervez Musharraf, who sacked the Chief Justice of Pakistan, appointed over 100 judges illegally, violating the constitution of Pakistan. And there was a huge movement in the street, and I participated in that movement, and I wish you could have seen, you know, people saying, we want our legal system restored. We want our Chief Justice back. And ultimately, they won. Musharraf was forced to resign. The Chief Justice is now again the Chief Justice of Pakistan. And a recent ruling shows that the 100 judges that were appointed by the military dictator, General Pervez Musharraf, are completely illegal and in contravention to the constitution of Pakistan, and they must be replaced, they must be sacked. So there's, you know, all kinds of reasons to feel optimistic.
Thank you so much for joining us. My guest is David Barsamian, a broadcaster, a writer, and the founder and director of Alternative Radio, the Boulder, Colorado-based syndicated show, which is heard over some 125 radio stations in various countries. How can people access your books and your radio show?
It's all on my website, alternativeradio.org, alternativeradio.org. Hope one day, you know, my weekly one-hour program, you know, will be heard on CJSF. I know there's a lot of people in British Columbia that are looking for news and information that challenge and counter the official story and general propaganda that the corporate media are so adept at spreading. So alternativeradio.org. Please visit the site. There's, you know, DVDs free to load down, some free audio, some interviews, some speeches. You can find a lot of things. And then I have, of course, a huge Noam Chomsky archive, Michael Parenti, Howard Zinn, Let's not forget the great Canadian Naomi Klein, Elaine Bernard. I just did a program with David Suzuki of BC.
Thank you so much for joining us, David. David is also a writer, and he writes regularly for magazines like The Progressive, The Nation, Zed Magazine, and others. Thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome.